A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hey, the name of the podcast is The Alt in Our Stars. The name of me is Chris Payne. I'm your host today. And usually we have cool bands on the podcast. We're going to switch it up this week. We're going to have some hopefully cool journalists on talking about things. I know we're not as fun as a band, so we'll try to be extra interesting. And I'm actually pretty confident we will, because we have a pretty good panel assembled here today to talk about our topic, which is streaming. It's something that in the music industry in general is always in the discussion. But lately, it's been pretty big outside the music space. A lot of that's because of Tidal, the streaming service relaunched by Jay-Z at the end of March. It's a premium streaming service that you can only pay for. The premium $20 per month membership includes lossless files, not compressed, which Spotify doesn't have. It was unveiled at a live unveiling, streamed online last month with Kanye, Jack White, Madonna, Nicki Minaj, all signing a contract. It's got people talking. So beyond that, I want to talk about what streaming means for artists, because it's an alternative music podcast. So I want to talk especially about what it means for smaller and indie artists who are often said to be like left out of the conversation with streaming. So some interesting, pertinent things I want to talk to. So introduce who we have on the show today. Sitting to my left, we have Billboard business editor Andrew Flanagan.
Thank you for that confidence-boosting introduction, Chris.
This is your first time on my podcast, I know. Have you been on a podcast before?
Yeah.
Okay.
I was on whatever Joe's podcast is called.
It was the new music podcast.
Yes.
Remember?
Totally.
The new music.
Talk to Sleater Kinney.
Yeah. Okay.
Glad to be here.
Okay. Awesome. Glad to have you. And we have charts manager Emily White.
Hello.
And charts manager William Gruger.
Hello.
Hey, so I have a nice little team assembled here. And Flan, Andrew Flanagan, you're called Flan to introduce you to the world, to my podcast. you have a pretty good perspective on the nitty-gritty of why artists make what they do on streaming, which people often rail against. Artists themselves take to Twitter, write think pieces. Oh, my God, I only get paid 1/10 of a cent for every stream. It's so unfair. But your perspective on this, and you write about this, work with this a lot, is that it really isn't so much the streaming service's fault for all that.
No, they pay a rate, and they pay the labels money, and that's a set rate. They take their cut, they pay the labels, and then there's a big filter between the rights holder, which generally means the label that controls the music, and what they pay that artist. And that's all dependent on the contract they have with that label, and those vary wildly. For instance, Jeff Barrow just tweeted yesterday or 2 days ago that he got £1,700 from 34 million streams, which is roughly half the normal rate of 0.0009 cents per stream. He got like 0.0005. So that's just how much it can vary.
Mm-hmm.
And that there's rhyme or reason to it, but there's also a lot of play in where that money goes.
Mm-hmm. So you said the rights holders is the ones who basically dictate the rates, not the streaming service.
Those are established by negotiations that happen biannually between rights holding bodies like Merlin, which is an independent label organization, and the major labels, which control most of it. So those rates are established every 2 years. And that's coming up at the end of the summer, I believe.
Okay. So it's basically the labels who dictate the rates, is what you're saying.
Labels and, independent trade bodies, mm-hmm. like Merlin.
Okay. And would the independent trade bodies be with people who are outside of the major label game?
Is that what that is?
Are the independent label bodies like Merlin, is that for artists who are outside of the major label game?
Yes, generally. Mm-hmm. Emily looked like she wanted to weigh in on something there.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, that's the way it works for any type of retailer, whether it's physical retail, whether it's iTunes, or whether it's streaming. You know, retailers pay rights holders. They, in most cases, are not paying artists directly. And I think that's the biggest misconception out there, is exactly what Andrew's talking about. Like, there's all of this stuff that happens in between that is a little more difficult for the public to understand. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the key to how money is being distributed between retailers and artists. It's that middle layer that's the most important.
And that middle layer, this is William jumping in, differs from artist to artist. It deals from organization to rights holders, and most of those are all under NDAs, all under closed doors. Mm-hmm. It's between the rights holders, so which is the label, and the service provider. So sometimes mm-hmm. the artists don't really even see how they break down, and it varies from person to person. So, you know, while you have people like Jay-Z who raps, I own my own masters, you know, I ain't missing no royalty statements in the We Made It remix. That might differ for an artist whose career's heyday was in the 70s and there were no streaming contracts mm-hmm. or there were no streaming services. So there weren't mm-hmm. any streaming clauses written into their contract. And so all this money that, you know, could be earned off of their recorded music really isn't helping them out too much, because their deal that they signed a long time ago was never mm-hmm. even structured that way in the first place.
Well, but, you know, what about that entire class of artists that are using like a royalty administration aggregator like TuneCore or CD Baby, you know?
Sure. So, would you put those more in like the newer sort of like artists that are approaching the situation? Like,
I'm saying, yeah, if I'm an independent,
totally control their music.
Yeah. Exactly. So I'm an independent artist. I control my music. I own my own masters, and I'm using, you know, a royalty, you know, aggregation mm-hmm. distribution service like TuneCore, and I'm still getting a really bad rate.
They still don't make a ton of money.
Yeah.
Even when I don't have a label that's taking something off the top, so, you know, TuneCore mm-hmm. CD Baby do take, you know, usually they either have an upfront fee or they're taking a percentage of royalties, and it's much, much smaller than, you know, your typical major label deal probably is, but those artists are still.
And I mean, on the flip side, the scale of
streams
is mm-hmm. much higher.
So that's a really interesting problem, because streaming services create, you know, streaming services pay out according to scale. You need volume to make up
market share.
That paycheck. So, you know, what Emily's really getting at is that creates a really big problem for a lot of these artists who may be really great, may have very niche fan bases who might buy their albums. But in a streaming world, the numbers just aren't big enough mm-hmm. for them to generate an income that would guarantee a living.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. I mean, mm-hmm. and it tails off way, you know, the biggest artists, they make a good chunk of change. But that's also because they're the biggest artists. Mm-hmm. It's an exponential distribution, I would say.
And that's the story that's being sold to everyone is that, oh, you know, once streaming scales, obviously these rates go up, you know, as more consumers adopt on-demand streaming as the primary way they listen to music, you know, things get better. The rates will increase. Just hold tight. We'll convert free users into pay users. Just hold tight. It's going to scale.
We've been hearing it for how many years now?
But, I mean, if you look at, you know, Spotify, which is the biggest on-demand streaming service in the world, I mean, Flan, do you know what the updated, like, worldwide user number is?
The 60 million.
So 60 million.
15 million paid users.
Yeah, so 60 million total, 15 million paid. I wish we could pull up how many people subscribe to Netflix. What is that number? Mm-hmm. You know,
a third of America, 40
yeah,
million.
Yeah, exactly. And 60 million is what percentage of music consumers in the world? You know, that's like 1% You know, I'm obviously playing around with numbers here, but, you know, obviously the scale isn't here now, but, you know, the growth rate has not been awesome either. So it kind of leaves a lot of people frustrated because the reality right now is that the rates are bad for a lot of people.
Yes,
with some exceptions. I mean,
I've talked to independent artists that don't really care about the rates either because they're moving past looking at streaming as a revenue generator and more of a social media platform to connect to their fans and relying on either tour revenues, which fine, but like also sites like Patreon.
Yeah.
Where they can.
Which is the right attitude to have right now because all you can really do is embrace the new technology while it's here instead of fighting it.
It seems sustainable, but do you really think like. I mean, it seems like it's the best attitude to have, but is it sustainable? Because if you're basically an artist who's outside of that upper echelon and you're just conceding that you're not really going to make money off of album sales, streaming, or anything, and you're totally putting your livelihood as an artist in touring and merch and stuff like that, is that sustainable?
I mean, it's interesting because when you ask that question, you sort of get into the idea of values. Like, where's the value in the music? Are we valuing the music? Or are we valuing, like, the experience? Or where exactly is the value, like, monetary value being created? I was going to say, like, you know, this, you know, we can kind of dovetail maybe into, like, Taylor Swift's chief argument off of this and saying, like, oh, I don't like streaming services because they offer music for free. And if you give something away for free, it's inherently speaks to the fact that it's
the
less value.
Value of it. Yeah.
And, yeah, I'll let somebody else jump in.
Well, I was going to say, William, I know you have thoughts on sort of the ripple effects of that kind of message.
Yeah. It's pretty obnoxious. So, you know, Taylor Swift, to kind of recap and bring up, you know, Taylor Swift did a very bold maneuver around her release of 1989 by deciding to keep it off of Spotify and streaming services.
To keep it off of the free, any streaming service with a free tier.
Correct.
It was the message.
So,
although
1989 was never on any of them. But she took her back catalog off of she took off of all the services that had a free tier. And she had a very public statement, which more or less said, offering music for free devalues music. I'm not willing to make that stand. But so let's look at, like, what exactly does a freemium tier do? What Emily sort of said is that, you know, there's this conversion rate factor. There's a very small pie of people who listen to music that sign up for these services. The more people, you know, we just discussed
that's,
earlier.
That sign up for freemium or just any of the part
that
of the
sign
service?
Up to pay for music services. And so, you know, as Emily pointed out, the more people that sign up, the better it is for everybody because these services, as Flan pointed out, scale and they offer more payouts based on how they scale. So the idea is the more people you can get to sign up, the better. So what's a way to get people to pay money for something is to offer a free tier. That's just an internet thing.
Which is something that Spotify has defended vociferously.
Yes.
And repeatedly.
They are the loudest proponents of it.
And free music is very, very expensive for Spotify because they absorb the cost of all of the freeloading. You know, ad-supported streaming does not make a lot of revenue. You know, Spotify makes whatever money it's making basically from subscriptions and from subscribers.
And probably from a lot of advertising.
Well, they make more from subscribers than they
really?
Make from advertising.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, ad-supported
the major labels
streaming.
Have equity in Spotify and they get a piece of that advertising.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which, as far as I understand, doesn't have to be paid back to artists. Anyway, sorry to interrupt.
No, it's okay. I mean, ad-supported streaming, that freemium layer that we're talking about is not a big revenue generator. You know, vinyl sales generated more money for the industry last year than ad-supported streaming did at whole.
Wow.
And vinyl sales are like 1% of the recorded music.
So, but as you know, as William says, the proposition there and the reason that Spotify is willing to lose so much money, you know, millions of dollars on free music is because it's, you know, considered to be a funnel. You know, it's supposed to convert You know, you get people in the door by offering them a really awesome experience that's better than, you know, downloading files. And you get them hooked on that experience, and then you hope that they sign up to pay. But, you know, the questions from the, you keep your fingers crossed that...
You really hate those ads, and you just can't take it anymore.
Well, definitely. Yeah. And so, I mean, the industry is kind of, you know, is wondering how effective that free tier is.
Spotify maintains that they have a 25% year-over-year conversion rate between free and their premium tier. So that number, according to them, or this method of theirs, is working to some degree to attract paying customers from those who otherwise would not be paying a subscription fee.
Hulu's paid free-to-paid user conversion rate 4 years ago was 3%.
3%. Spotify's is 25%?
Netflix is 93%.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Netflix has a free tier?
No, I don't think they do.
No.
That would contribute to their excellent conversion rate.
Conversion rate from nothing?
Well, they have the 30-day trial. That must be what that is.
Yeah.
Tidal had a free trial.
Yeah, let's talk about Tidal.
Which I signed up for, and then my credit card was charged $20.
Yeah.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
It's a business expense. You can take that off on your taxes.
So yeah, Emily wrote a pretty good post sizing up Tidal for Billboard last month. So could you summarize that for us?
Sure. I signed up for Tidal and...
Sorry.
I used it. It's okay.
At my behest.
I used it on the bus. I used it in the subway. I used it at home. And just to kind of get a look at how the product currently, you know, worked in its current iteration. Obviously,
Emily,
Jay-Z.
Let me just interject quickly. Emily's like a streaming music connoisseur. Like, she knows all of it inside and out. So we had her do a little review.
Thanks.
Anyway.
Yeah, so I just kind of wanted to look at how the product worked. And obviously, this was an existing product that Jay-Z purchased. I think a lot of mainstream consumers didn't really realize that the product had been around in the U.S. since October. So there was a lot of excitement over the launch, but the launch just sort of equated to the launch event and some new content on the service. But
and the merger of Wimp and Tidal.
Yeah. But the existing service didn't change all that much.
So it's basically just take a look at this, we're making it public, putting it out there.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Yeah, and exactly. And it has sort of, as I think I say in the article, like all the bells and whistles of most on-demand streaming services. Like they all sort of have the same standard feature set. So there's a radio function. There's playlists. There's artist pages. There's artist bios. You know, a lot of it is really the same.
Is this social, too?
No. Okay. So there are a couple things that are missing.
Sorry.
So there's no social layer. So you can't see sort of in Spotify how you see that stream of what your friends are listening to. There's nothing like that in Tidal yet. There's also just a couple of
There's no Last.fm Scrobbler yet. I checked, but I think it's coming.
That's why I stopped using Beats. I couldn't Scrabble, so I just got out of there.
Scrabbling is from like 2003.
But
you
I still
if it
like
didn't
it.
Scrabble,
I still enjoy
does
it
exist?
Though.
Did I listen to
Maybe
it?
Maybe you should just enjoy the music and not the numbers the music provide you.
I have a friend. I have a friend who, whenever he listens to a record on, you know, whenever he listens to vinyl, he puts the corresponding album on his computer and mutes
it. That's fucking ridiculous.
So that the scrabbles count.
Wow.
Yeah, so the worst I had seen was, well, I don't know if you'd say worst. I saw someone who had a disclaimer on their Last FM that they also listened to lots of vinyl and that it was not accounted for in the Last FM statistics.
Jesus Christ. I used Last FM scrabbling for a week, and then I was like, why the fuck am I... What do I care? Let me just get into the weeds here a little bit. Like, what do you guys get out of it, like, emotionally?
Because it's like my history. It's like,
I had it since I was in high school.
Are you kidding me?
Like,
it's Do you know how many spoon scrabbles I have?
I just found out a few weeks ago, like, Kanye West passed the Beatles as my, like, most listened to artist of all time. Like, that's dope to know.
If I had this in
high school, like, I wonder how high Metallica would have been on this list.
I'm pretty sure J.K. Rowling is in my top 10 because of all of the Harry Potter audiobooks. Excuse me.
So you guys are data crunching your aesthetic lives.
Yeah, I
can see like a week by I can think about an important week in my life and see what I was listening to.
Okay.
That week.
Yeah.
You know?
All right.
I like having that record.
I would be curious to like see my just got dumped playlist, I guess.
It's also like you see your weird listening habits. Like, wow, I listened to Yonkers by Tyler the Creator a lot. Like, why?
And at the end of every year I can pull and see, you know, what albums I listened to the most that year.
It's great.
I mean, you know, at the end of last year everyone was sharing those My Year in Spotify graphics that were pulled from their Spotify listening history that were showing, you know, what I listened to what artists the most of that season, you know, what device I was using to listen. You know, I figured they had a couple different other signifiers. But I do, going back to Tidal for a second.
Yeah, sorry.
My favorite thing about Tidal is that there's this weird little Easter egg in Tidal. On the phone, when you use the mobile app, you can go to a little side menu that is track info, and it shows you song credits. So it shows you like writer credits, producer credits, engineer credits. Like, it only shows it where it's available. So it's not for every song. And, you know, the credits for every song aren't complete. But I think I point out in the article, if you go to Sam Smith's Stay With Me, it lists Tom Petty as a songwriter. So it's up to date.
You're Emily's also a metadata crusader.
Yes. Well, because, I mean, this is, you know, a big thing sort of when we're having these discussions about how all of these different products look and work is that there's kind of a, it's a little disappointing, you know? This type of service has been around since, when did Rhapsody launch, you know?
2000?
Like, on-demand streaming is not new, but, you know, advancements we've seen in these kind of features. Like, Spotify just launched a feature where you can see lyrics, you know, corresponding as you're listening to a song.
That's
really
good.
So you click a tab, and they use Music Match, and it plays the lyrics in line with the song. That just happened in 2015.
Or you know what would be neat if it's something that...
So many different feature sets. Go ahead.
The next step could be like a kind of a Rap Genius sync, where not only do you get lyrics in time with the song, but you get in sync annotations.
Yeah,
that'd be
kind of
neat.
That would be awesome. It just seems...
Everyone wants that, not just music nerds. Everyone.
It seems insane to me that... we don't have like album credits or song credits in streaming services at a mass level. It seems insane to me that, you know, that lyrics aren't automatically there. You know, it's insane.
Well, there's a historical, I guess, sort of maybe precedent for that, which is like, you know, the music industry was built upon selling records, and artists made a lot of their money off of selling these records.
Mm-hmm.
But the way what metadata directly applies to in the streaming world is where rights are allocated, who rights are allocated towards. And when those are wrong or incomplete or messed up, or that means that people aren't getting paid. That means that songs maybe like aren't getting picked up on Content ID on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
It means that songwriters aren't getting paid. Publishers aren't getting paid. It means that like just the money isn't being allocated towards the right people.
And to like boil that down for a second, that can be something as simple as J-Z or J-D. Like, that's a metadata error that can, you know, cause huge problems in linking tracks, in, you know, associated, you know, rates and money. You know,
yeah. it's where how money is allocated.
Think how much money Engelbert Humperdinck has lost in his career due to metadata snafus.
People aren't spelling his name correctly.
Yeah,
and it's like when there's a missed character or a misappropriated producer, the field is left blank, or there's a bunch of garbage that shows up.
Yeah,
when ads are running, mm-hmm. and the computer records that an ad ran against J-Z's music, mm-hmm. then it can't find an artist named J-Z, so then it puts into a slush fund. I mean, I think every year, what's Harry Fox or what's the rights collecting organization?
Sound Exchange. Yeah. Unclaimed money from Sound Exchange because people aren't registered with Sound Exchange, and for all those problems William just mentioned, like there's a huge pool of money that just can't be matched to the appropriate rights holder.
I've got it right here, actually.
What's the number? Tell us.
$96 million.
What? $96 million.
Which is a drop of $25 million from 2013.
Drop.
So just let that sink in.
It improved by $25 million to $96 million, mm-hmm. which is give still it all a whole
because
bunch of money.
Basically, I mean to bring
but
this back.
Also, that also happens with artists. Like, if you have a friend that's in a band and they get played on Pandora somehow, and mm-hmm. they don't sign up with Sound Exchange, mm-hmm. Sound Exchange can't pay you if they don't know who the hell you are.
Well, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, that goes back to because services are missing that key information of session musicians, featured players. Exactly what you just said. Like, that's a whole other ball mm-hmm. game. Like, but we're just talking
classical
about
recordings.
The featured artist. Right. We're talking about the featured artist.
Yeah.
It's insane. And to bring it back to what we were talking about in the beginning, it's sort of because there's this misconception that Spotify is making all of these payments, where Spotify is just sort of reporting a play log to intermediaries who are responsible for distributing and allocating. It's Spotify, doesn't have the infrastructure to make those payments. They sort of outsource the messy, complicated process of divvying up that money.
You mean artist distribution?
Hmm?
You mean artist distribution or just the money they are making?
The money they are making.
Okay. Yeah, because they pay the labels, ASCAP, mm-hmm. BMI,
exactly.
and CSAC.
And then they figure out how to split that up.
Yep.
She's like, you take it from there. Mm-hmm.
So a few more things I want to touch on here. Flan, you were talking about how a small band I'm getting paid on Pandora, you would have to register in order to see that money. I want to just link this back to the Alt and Our Stars, the theme of the podcast, turn things over to smaller musicians, maybe unsigned or signed with a smaller, more DIY indie label.
Mm-hmm.
If you were giving advice, or if you were that artist, what would you sign? What would you do? What wouldn't you do? How would you guide your career?
There's services, like Emily mentioned, like TuneCore, that are very bare-boned, and you can pay them a very small flat fee. I think it's $50. I can't remember off the top of my head, mm-hmm. but
they have a set fee per album.
Maybe
per
99
song.
Bucks now. But anyway, each year you pay them this set fee, and they put all your stuff on YouTube, Spotify, everything. And they kind of take care of that aspect of it, leaving you some room to not have to negotiate that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great. Services like Bandcamp, which kind of centralize your social media profile.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of places where an independent artist can go to simplify their relationship to the digital music marketplace, essentially. Leaving you, because I have a lot of friends in bands, and they don't have a lot of time between working a day job or whatever to work on actual music and also work on reaching their fans.
Yeah.
Which is, that last part is the most important part, reaching out to whoever likes you and making sure that they know what you're up to.
Yeah, I mean, just to dovetail off what Flan is saying, it's just a matter of like keeping it all connected. So like using a service like that, that's really simple. They do all the heavy lifting for you so that, everything is correct, one, but that, it helps you to be able to use these services as more of a platform, because they're not really going to be a revenue generating standpoint, because what we said earlier, they don't scale big enough.
Especially for an indie band.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody knows about you. So yeah. Like,
but like if you use a centralized place like Bandcamp to have all of your social profiles in one place, and through a place like TuneCore, have all of your music correctly distributed out everywhere, and all of that is found on your Bandcamp profile, You know, you create a world where people can find you and make it very, very easy to listen to you.
Mm. I mean, another feature set that took, you know, on-demand streaming a long time to adapt, which seems really natural, is just putting tour dates next to an artist profile page.
That
putting,
took forever to
putting
figure
links
out.
To merch, you mm-hmm. know, things that seem really
and Facebook too took
simple
forever just to
and
make
natural.
That.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, like I in whatever 2008, making a band page on Facebook was the biggest pain in the ass.
Yeah, they mm-hmm. lagged behind MySpace because even though they were so much more advanced and cooler than MySpace at that point, MySpace was such a big thing with profiles for musicians, and Facebook was just mm-hmm. like, oh, college student profiles. Yep.
Yeah. But
they took it over
it's
now,
better now,
but
it's
it
much
took time.
Better, like Emily mm-hmm. was saying.
Yeah. Which that's another thing I think I pointed out in the title articles. They don't seem to be incorporating those types of links yet.
Right.
And that's really important. I mean, that's what leads a big factor in, say, Spotify's success is their connection with Facebook's social graph. Now, if you ignore the connection and ownership, and I think Sean Parker is in bed with both camps, mm-hmm. but like Spotify is very, very much engaged with Facebook, and it leverages Facebook's social graph. And just, you know, that also contributes to the biggest artists getting the most amount of plays because they're related. But, you know, the Lady Gaga will carry more edge rank than, you know, an indie band. But, you know, that's just if you can use streaming services to leverage social, that's a really huge inherent value to having your stuff correctly distributed across streaming services to an independent artist.
And one thing to back up about Tidal was that something to consider is that Apple bought Beats streaming service over a year ago, and they still haven't launched it, you know? Mm-hmm. Jay-Z and the 16 other friends of his, the Super Friends, they bought they bought it, and they launched it in like a month. So I think that those features are going to be rolling out, mm-hmm. but it's just so brand new.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I mean,
yeah. And that makes me think that, like, that consolidation, I mean, a lot of them are all the same. They have the same catalog, but I bet they're going to look the same.
Yeah, that's a kind of a worry point for me going forward is, you know, if you're to sort of graph out the sort of, like, innovation curve of these streaming services, in my mind, it's sort of flattened out. You know, as Emily sort of pointed out, you know, Tidal is very similar to Spotify. I even think like the icons on the browse page.
There's a screenshot on Billboard.com.
Yeah, they're very. And so up until now, this has been a tech war first, a tech battle first, and a content battle second. But as differentiation amongst the different platforms is flatlining, and that there you really can't make anything better than what Spotify or Beats is. I mean, it's all the same thing. So, all right. So then, how do you compete in the market?
I don't know if that's true.
I
think you can make something better.
What it would look like?
Because you know the problem that we keep
well,
talking
don't
about.
Don't tell
here,
them you'll lose yeah. your billions of dollars.
The problem we keep talking about here is, you know, that conversion rate of not just free to paid subscribers, but of music listeners to on-demand streaming service users, you know? So how do you get the masses to sign up for something that in our minds is like, oh, man, access to nearly all the world's recorded music in this easy-to-use mobile app and desktop app? Sure, I'll sign up. That sounds awesome. But to the average consumer, you know, they're not signing up yet. So how do you make a product that they want to sign up for?
So the average listener being like the 12-year-old girl is going to go and listen to Lady Gaga 15 times in a row on YouTube.
Yeah.
The average listener is someone that is going to go to Spot or Pandora and hit a button and deal with five ads.
Exactly. That's an amazing point. So when you talk about, you know, maybe these services have gotten as good as they're going to get, you know, I think a core thing that Spotify is trying to tackle is that easy button and that lean back experience. And, you know, that's why they bought the Echo Nest is to work on that. So what does a service look like where you log on and you press an easy button and it plays exactly what you want to hear? I think that's the question that they're working towards.
I mean, it looks like Pandora.
I don't when I press Pandora, it doesn't play what I want to hear.
Yeah,
I
almost exclusively go off my own iTunes. So
yeah, I mean, we're getting into a conversation where, you know, you're addressing the needs of like what a mass market consumer wants, and then you're having a bunch of people who like live and breathe music, like, you know, apply their like very niche specific like Last right. FM angry needs
people that go to like even way within, too many shows
even
a month
within and, that even within you know generally I know what I want to listen to. There are absolutely moments where I just like want to I just want to press a button and I just want it to work and I just want to like it.
Yeah. Just put Eno on Pandora.
Yeah. Or just click browse, and then I go to the Indie Chill playlist on Spotify.
It's not good enough for me.
Well, one last thing, as we're starting to run out of time, I believe, in this room in our office, I wanted to close on, like, look to the future a little bit. And, like, say 10 years ago, if it was 2005, illegal downloading was more of the hot button issue. The legal alternative was basically, if you're not buying the CD in a store, the Apple iTunes store. Now things are much more cloud oriented. Streaming is the way to go, even though those other alternatives still exist. So let's say 10 years in the future, 2025, where do you guys see things heading?
Well, hopefully we'll all have self-driving cars and my commute experience, not my commute, but you know, lots of people's commute experience will be just lounging back, having that easy button that we talked about before that is automatically playing them a mix of spoken word content, video content, music content. It is completely in tune to what time of day it is, what mood it's in, what their heart rate is.
The weather,
what's on their calendar, who else is in the car. So
that's not even that crazy.
It's melding taste profile with Flan's taste profile and Gerger's taste profile and playing something that the three of us might enjoy.
What did that look like? St. Vincent, Flying Lotus.
Yeah, pretty much. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. It'll just be those two on repeat.
But it'll be like a mashup that's like to our heartbeats or something. please not. I don't want that. And then whatever I'm listening to in my in my driverless car stays with me as I leave the car. It's in my kitchen on my awesome, I don't know, what will speakers be like?
You don't even remember what solid food tastes like.
I don't know. What do you guys think?
I'm a little less optimistic. I just feel like, you know, to continue with the thought I was saying earlier about, like, you know, if there's not a lot of, I don't think there's that much innovation to be had on the platforms. So what I think is going to start to happen, if what we're seeing literally today with Jay-Z dropping his video only on Tidal, any indication, is that the way these platforms are going to start to try and differentiate themselves is by making exclusivity windows on their content.
So we're looking 10 years into the future, though, right?
I think we're still going to be dealing with those silos.
Where that's, we've done everything we can.
Mm-hmm. I think that, let's say, like, going indie becomes cool, and instead of like being beholden to a major rights holder, the biggest artists in the world, Drake, Taylor Swift, Jay-Z, decide to forego that cost and just like hire their own CEO and be their own platform, and then like maybe you would pay.
You just subscribe to your favorite artist, and that's it. There's no middleman.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's what Tyler the Creator is trying with Whale Rock and with his app.
And Jaden Smith.
Bandcamp is going to start offering that soon.
So instead of asking someone you meet, like, oh, like, what bands are you into? You'd be like, yo, what kind of lifestyle brands are you into?
Well, no, it'd be more like, oh, I subscribe. You know, I pay $5 a month for OVO. I pay $5 a month for Rock Nation.
Drip FM does that.
Yeah. Mm. But that's not cool yet. You know what I'm saying? Like, major artists aren't going to do that because major artists benefit more from going through major distribution.
I mean, that's the way things go. It's a constant.
You just touched on something very important, which is that the structures around distribution of an artist that has tens of millions of fans requires major investment,
correct?
Which requires powerful people with a lot of money to build the infrastructure to do that. And those people also have the power to control the legislative process around streaming services, consent decrees, publishing royalties, and on and on. So my prediction is that people who have a lot of power are going to continue to have a lot of power.
Well, and like what you talked about is like being able to subscribe like individually to individual artists. I mean, that's just sort of the pattern that content goes through. It gets bundled and it gets unbundled and it gets bundled and it gets unbundled. Yeah, yeah. Like this is the next, it's all going to get unbundled into all these different individual pockets, and then we're all going to get really frustrated with that and bundle it all up again.
And the internet will break it like it always does.
Yeah,
exactly.
There are bundles. The internet breaks the bundles. The internet makes new bundles. That's cool. That's yeah.
There'll be that some new thing that comes on that people do that maybe won't even be music. It'll be Oculus Rift watching Snapchat all day or something.
So there you have it.
The future.
Well, thanks for a great discussion, guys. I mean, I came into this not really having a deep knowledge of this kind of stuff, and I feel like I learned a lot. So
thank you for having me.
It was a pleasure. Absolute pleasure. So that concludes episode of The Alt in Our Stars. We'll be back next week, next Friday, as we run every single Friday on Billboard.com. We'll have an interview with Speedy Ortiz, whose new album is absolutely fantastic. So tune in then, and remember, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes by clicking the link towards the bottom of the story. You can also listen to archived episodes in there, too. Waxahachie was recently on the podcast, All Time Low. Pete Wentz from way back. Lots of good stuff in there, so check that out. Until next time, have a good weekend, guys.